You discover that someone you know once belonged to a cult. It's hard to believe. This is an intelligent, rational person. How could they possibly have submitted to a life controlled by others? What is the compelling power of a cult? There's been some renewed interest in this topic lately. There's the TV series Wild Wild Country about the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Also a podcast about Heaven's Gate. And here in Life Matters, I want to understand the psychology at work behind these sorts of cults and what makes someone want to be in one. And are cults, by definition, always bad? Tora Clevier is a counsellor who deals in cults and religious abuse. He's a former member of a Christian cult, the Children of God, that started in the United States. And Mary Garden spent 7 years in various Hindu sects and cults in India. She's subsequently written about her experiences as she's tried to process why. Tora, in your experience, what are the major features that define a group as a cult? What makes a group cultish?
Yes, hello, Amanda. The defining features really are the abuse and coercion rather than religious beliefs. Many people think that a cult is just a strange religion or a strange set of belief systems. But the defining factors are more the abusive things. Such as having rights and freedoms taken away from the members, and instilling in them an extremism and a sense of black and white thinking.
And as you say, Tora, there's lots of religious groups and sects might look strange from the outside, but that doesn't necessarily make them a cult. Mary, as someone who's lived in and studied and written about cults, would you add anything to Tora's description?
I think you have to be very, very careful with using the word cult because groups change over time. And I think every individual devotee or a member of a group is going to have quite a different experience. And with reference to the Rajneesh group, in the time that I was there in Pune, I would say there was no hallmarks of the cult at that time. And many of us were, it was only when they moved to Oregon and set up an intentional community. Most of us were living outside the ashram. There was no control at all. We decided what we wanted to do, what we wanted to participate in. Those in the inner circle obviously had quite a different experience. Mm. So I think we've got to be quite careful with the use of the word of the term cult. I know some academics go to the extreme and say we shouldn't be using it at all. We should be using the term new religious movements. But I think at times groups do morph into cults, and a lot of it comes about when they isolate themselves from society and when there's a group leader who self-professes to be God incarnate, like Rajneesh did. I think that's the real danger with some of these Eastern cults, where the guru is considered, greater than God or a vehicle of God, and you can't question them.
And Tora, how do people come to join a cult?
Vulnerabilities usually lead people into cults. They have a time in their life when they're very needy for whatever reason, and it varies hugely because a cult isn't necessarily religious either. The dynamic of control and abuse can exist, in meditation groups, in religious groups, in self-help groups. So what makes one person vulnerable may be a religious belief, and what makes another person vulnerable may be a desire for self-improvement.
And is it kind of about, do you actually make a conscious decision? I mean, you've been through this, make a conscious decision, I'm going to join this group, or is it about somehow being seduced into it?
Yes, it's often said that no one sets out to join a cult. People don't go down a list of known cults and choose one and think, oh, this is the philosophy that best suits me. They tend to get seduced into it at a time that they're needy in their life. And the key thing to remember is that they don't know what they're joining. This is where the coercion comes into it. If people knew up front what all the beliefs of the group were, they would probably never join. But it's a slow indoctrination process where the inside doctrine of the group is released over time.
And Tori, what led you to, what were the circumstances that led you to join the Children of God?
I had pretty much all the vulnerabilities possible going on. My mother had passed away a year earlier. I was travelling alone in Europe and I was actively searching for something because I was dissatisfied with society and what it had to offer.
At what age was this?
I was 21 going on 22 years old.
Right. Well, Mary, for you, I think it started with being drawn to Eastern spirituality when you were at university in New Zealand in the 70s. What was your state of mind like at that time, would you say? What was the attraction for you?
I think at that time I was going through a very difficult phase. I was quite depressed. Not that I knew that I was depressed. Back in the 70s, that was a concept. We didn't really discuss how we felt. And I had started yoga at a very young age, at 16. So I went out to a yoga ashram. And I think it's this feeling of belonging to a group and that sense of family. I never had that as a child. I grew up in a very odd, eccentric family. Very dysfunctional on a social level. There was no laughter, no joy, no sense of, you know, we never had visitors and people staying. My father was very odd. I've actually just written a book about his interesting life story. And I think it was the feeling of belonging to a group and being accepted. And then there's also all the rituals as well. I think, you know, you can underestimate the power of the feelings you get with the mantras and the very rituals. It's very, very hypnotic. Mm. And I just thought, wow, this is what it was all very new in the 1970s. You've got to realise there'd been no exposés or warnings of these groups, and tens of thousands of us Westerners went over to India in the footsteps of the Beatles. And I decided to leave university and get rid of my possessions and take off. And at the, you know, I was so happy, and I just had not felt that degree of happiness in my whole life. I thought, this is what I'm looking for.
Well, Mary, you spent some years with a few different gurus in India, and it wasn't all bad, but one experience was particularly abusive. Now, without mentioning any individuals or the name of the particular cult, just summarise for us a bit what happened.
Well, that was a small yoga ashram up in the Himalayas, and there were only a few Westerners there. It was very isolated. And most of us who go into these groups, especially with a charismatic leader, it's like we have this love affair. We fall in love with them. We think we're in the honeymoon phase for a long time. And especially with the Indian groups where we think that guru is enlightened, and it means that you can't question them. So it's very much like an extreme version of domestic violence, like it's all your fault. So it means that the guru can get away with doing anything, abusive, whatever, and that's rationalised as him, his drama or playing a game to wake us up. So everything that happens and what we go through, it's all our fault. So you do get trapped and you doubt yourself, and
now,
you're not allowed to doubt in a situation like that. You know, there's extreme pressure to believe everything he says and to be devoted. And I'm just very grateful I managed to get away.
Well, Tora, what kind of methods were used in your experience in the cult you're in to keep you there, to embed you in the group?
There's a number of methods of control that are used. When you first come in, there's like it's commonly termed love bombing, where you are really the centre of the universe. You've met this wonderful group of people who all want to be your best friend. They all want to know everything about you. There was a lot of love, a lot of hugs, a lot of affirmation. And it just really felt like a type of paradise. It's like, wow, I found this family that I never had. So that was the start. And as time goes on, the love that was shown becomes more conditional on your participation and on your submitting to the belief systems which are released to you incrementally. If at any point you question the beliefs that they present to you, they sort of back off and justify it and say, oh, no, we didn't really mean that. It's not that we believe that he's is the end-time prophet of God. He's just like a minister. And so they would just mellow things out until you came to a point where you were under enough control. Like one of the first things we did was give all our money to the group, so that cut off a way home. We were encouraged to write letters to parents and family saying that we now have a new family.
Yes, you wrote to your father and just said that that was it. You were not having anything to do with him anymore, I think.
Yes, I wrote to him and said, you're no longer my father.
How heartbreaking for him.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's one of my greatest regrets. So there's this process of cutting off your old life and embracing the new. And that's affirmed so much as a badge of allegiance and a badge of courage that you just tend to go with it, because your whole social life, your friends, your work, your vision for the future, everything that you are gets wrapped up in the group.
Here in Life Matters, the psychology of cults. Former Christian cult member Tora Clevier specialises in helping people who've left a cult to adjust and recover. And Mary Garden spent time with and has written about a few different cults in India. Now, what do you think it is that draws people into a cult? Can you imagine yourself being attracted to one? Perhaps you have been. You can tell us on Facebook. Mary, what was it that led you to finally be able to break away from that abusive cult you're in northern India?
Oh, look, it was a long process. I think the other thing I didn't mention, and I did go round, and many of us did traipse around a lot of the gurus in India, and I went to India with the expectation that I was going to be a celibate nun and that I wasn't going to have to worry about men again. But many of us actually ended up having sex with our gurus, and that was considered like, you know, a divine thing, that they were erasing bad karma from us.
Well, so you got pregnant to one, didn't you?
Many of us Westerners got pregnant. I got pregnant actually twice. The first time was, very late. I wasn't allowed to see a doctor because I didn't realise I was pregnant, and he thought it was just, my body was healing itself. So I had a very late term abortion. I ran away quite often, but I'd still be drawn back. I was completely under his spell. I mean, I thought that, he was this godlike figure and it was all my fault. I went back to New Zealand and luckily I actually ran into some Rajneesh people. I mean, I know that group did morph into quite a destructive cult when they went to Oregon, but these people were so different and they were so happy. So Rajneesh, ironically, was my way out of the cult.
Very interesting.
And the other interesting thing, going back to what Tori's saying, is that none of the groups that I was in ever tried to alienate me from my family. There was no pressure to cut off from my family. I would write the very bizarre letters back to my mother. I mean, if my daughter did that, I'd be on the plane straight away. But she would write back, just talk about the weather in New Zealand, and I'd be writing the most bizarre things that,
Well, I mean, I guess the point is too that, of course, not all cults are going to be the same.
Absolutely.
Tora, how and why did you make the decision to leave the Children of God?
Once again, it was a long process, really. It was a process over about a year. There was a time in the group where all leadership was demoted, and had to relearn submission. So it was a time of brainwashing is the only term I can really think, where every single movement, everything we did, including washing the dishes, was scrutinised and attributed to our spirituality. Our children at that time were...
Yes, because you within your time in that group, you married and you ended up having five children.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of pressure on our children as well, which impacted my wife. They couldn't really play outside, and it was a very insular kind of group. The children's lives were completely taken up in the group with homeschooling, and my wife saw a lot more of the lack of opportunities. But the real clincher was when I started, because of the pressure, to question some of the doctrines of the group, and that just wasn't allowed. So we were kicked out on temporarily first, hoping that we would repent and come back more submitted. And then when that didn't happen, we left and came back to Australia.
Well, Tora, in your experience, do, generally speaking, mental health professionals tend to understand how to help someone like you, your family, who has left a cult?
Generally speaking, it's still an area that needs a lot of work. There are mental health professionals that are coming up to speed with this, but many of them do not want to touch it.
Because?
They don't really understand it. They haven't taken the time to learn about it. And psychology is an area of specialisation, largely these days as well, where people tend to specialise in a certain area. It does require some special understanding. Either people see it as just another church that people have left, and they don't see the full breadth of the damage that can be caused when people are institutionalised in that way.
Well, Mary, what was your experience after 7 years all up in India, I think? What was your experience of moving on, of sort of emotional recovery, I suppose?
I also need to add that when I went to Pune, I mean, the first 2 years I was very happy, but things did start deteriorating and there were a lot of red flags, and my mother sent a newspaper clipping of the Jim Jones mass suicide, and I thought, I've got to get out of here. But when I came back to Brisbane, I mean, I just agree with Tori. I mean, I was obviously suffering post-traumatic stress from being with that Himalayan yogi who physically and mentally abused me quite severely. And I remember ringing up Lifeline saying, you know, I need help, I feel suicidal. And I went in to talk to someone, and at the end of the session she was saying, oh, that's so fascinating, what an interesting story. So I went to people over the years to try and get help, and they just had no understanding at all. And there were...
So what, they loved your story but couldn't help you?
They loved the story and they just... there were a few cult counsellors who were Christian-based who wanted me to become a born-again Christian. My big breakthrough, because I must admit I was quite ambivalent for 7 years, and during that time I, you know, was married and had two children, it was writing my book that completely, you know, was
which
my
was a sort of way
line.
Of
it was like,
processing
oh, my God,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, Tora, you're now a counsellor who specialises in helping people who've lived in cults or have suffered religious abuse. How do you help someone in that situation?
Initially, probably the most helpful thing for a person who's come out of a group is to realise that these people have been institutionalised. A lot of times they just don't know how to function in society. They may be completely cut off from networks of families, friends, and they may find it really difficult to feel understood by anyone because of the uniqueness of their experience. So information giving is a very good first step, where they learn about, in a psychoeducational format, the way that cults operate, and that all cults really operate in a very similar way, and that there is a pattern here. So if you learn about one cult, you've learned about all of them in effect, even though there is a sliding scale of abuse. And then after that, you can move more towards addressing things like phobias, addressing things like black and white thinking, post-traumatic stress. They may need referral for medication to a psychiatrist, for antidepressants, that sort of thing, to get them through the bad time. But many counsellors who see it just on a face value, for instance, may not attribute the damage that they're seeing in a person's life as to the cult. And that's the biggest mistake that therapists can make, is by asking people about their childhood or asking people about other factors and ignoring the impact that a cult can have on a person's life.
Well, if you want more info and help, there is something called the Cult Information and Family Service, and there's a link to that on the Life Matters website. Tora Clevier is a counsellor in Wollongong. He helps people with get over being in a cult, also religious abuse. For 11 years, he was a member of a Christian cult. And Mary Garden is a former cult member over 7 years in India. She now lives on the Sunshine Coast and tells her story in a book called The Serpent Rising. And if you want to share any of your own experiences or those of a family member, perhaps, with a cult, you can post a comment on Facebook. Don't say anything that'll get us or you sued, though, as well as Facebook. This is Life Matters.